Now that the emerald ash borer has made its appearance in the state, on this edition of Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, DNR forester Mark Vitosh and Extension horticulturist Richard Giron explained what you should know about the pest and its impact on ash trees. And they'll take your questions about the plants in your life you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, just after the news. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Julie Englander. We're talking plants with Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and DNR forester Mark Vitosh. They'll take your questions about anything you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Once again, that phone number, 1-866-780-9100. Horticulturist Richard Giron joins us in our AIM studio, and DNR forester Mark Vitosh is joining me in our Iowa City studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Good.
Good, good. Well, last week we broke the news that the emerald ash borer is indeed in Iowa. And I was just wondering if you'd want to recap anything about the borer's appearance, what people should know. Just some added information about what the future is.
Sure. Well, I think we all knew, and we've been talking about this for a number of years, that it wasn't a matter of if emerald ash borer was going to show up. It was when emerald ash borer was going to show up in Iowa. And it has showed up. They found it last week in northeast Iowa in Almaquis County. At this point, no quarantines have been set, but I think those are pending. Most likely in Almaquis County, any ash material, living or dead, and any hardwood-fired material won't be allowed out of that specific county. And when those details come out, we'll get more. But what folks need to understand, it's not time to panic. A month ago, somebody called from Iowa City, said they had an ash tree, had a broken branch. Should they just cut it down, or should they fix the broken branch? What it really comes down to, if you have a healthy ash tree, it's okay to leave it. This thing is going to keep moving over time. With quarantines, hopefully we can slow it down a little bit. But if you have a healthy tree, enjoy it as long as you can. If you have room for new species or new trees and diversity, you may think about that in the long term. We don't know how quickly this is going to move. This insect does not fly a long way, but it does move through firewood. So the big message here is do not move firewood and other ash material, really no matter where you are. If you're going camping the next holiday coming up, everyone's talking about camping for the Memorial holiday and stuff like that, keep firewood local. If you're going to go somewhere, get your firewood at that place. Don't bring it with you, because we could always... You know, even though it's in Almaquis County, it could be in other places in the state already that we have not identified yet. So you could be moving it. So keep firewood local. But the big thing is, if you have a tree, first identify it. Make sure it's an ash. There's good sources out there, and I'll give you a couple good websites to identify your tree. And then evaluate the health. If it's healthy, you're all right. And to me, you really have two choices. Your first choice is just let that tree go. Let it live as long as it. If it gets emerald ash borer, then you cut it down. The other option is there are chemical treatments available that if you choose, you could use to treat your tree. If you have a specific tree in your yard, you could use it to try to prevent emerald ash borer from attacking your tree. Now, the thing to understand is most of the chemicals available are going to need to be done commercially.
Meaning somebody else needs to
correct.
Do it, not the homeowner.
Well, there is a product or two out there for the homeowner that can be used, but those are generally limited to smaller trees, 8 inches or less. So if you get a tree that's 10, 12 inches or bigger, most likely you're going to have that done commercially by an arborist. The other thing is a lot of these chemicals you use as soil drenches, you pour in the soil. That can be damaging if it's not used correctly to water, to ponds, to lakes. Can be toxic. Mm. So a lot of times the injections are better for the tree and better for the environment. The thing is, too, not one chemical. Most of them you either have to treat on an annual basis or every 2 to 3 years. So once you commit to treating, you're going to have to continue to treat. The thing that we're saying right now is if you need to wait until you're within probably 15 miles of a known infestation before you start treating, if you choose to treat, because it could be 2 years, 5 years, or even 10 years before it shows up in your area. So it's important to wait. You don't have to, but we're recommending that you wait, because you could treat for 5, 6 years and it's not here and you're treating for a pest that's not there. So you always have that risk that may show up in your area, but that's, I think it's worth the risk. Just two last things. There's a good website called iowatreepest.com, and that's the Iowa Department of Ag Land Stewardship website. They'll have updates if we have quarantines and that kind of information. Okay. And then iowadnr.gov, that's our website, and you go to State Forest and Forestry, and you click on that, and there's actually an Emerald Ash Borer Resource Kit that has information on identifying ash, identifying symptoms, potential for emerald ash borer. The challenge that we have is there's a lot of ash trees out there that don't always look healthy. That doesn't mean that they have emerald ash borer.
That was another topic.
So that's right. So that's real key, because we've been talking about this for 5 years, and we talk about the symptoms, general dieback from the top, dead branches, stuff like that. Well, I've been seeing that for 10 years on ash trees, and we have other organisms and other things going on with ash trees too, and we even have some native borers that attack. So let's take our time, research things, understand things before you go forward. And on a number of those websites, there's actually a good publication from Iowa State called Emerald Ash Borer Management Options, and they talk about the chemical treatments available, the methods, the chemicals, and all those different things. People need to look at those things first before they make decisions.
Okay, so go to the website first. Don't panic. Main message here, don't bring in firewood from other places.
In Iowa. Don't move it now. We've been talking about that a lot here in the last couple of years.
Okay. We'll get some callers in, then we'll go to some other things about other diseases that ash trees can have. We'll go to Susan in Ankeny. Susan, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a rose bush, a climbing rose bush that's 2 years old, and it was overcrowding its spot, so we 2 weeks ago replanted it, and it looks terrible. All the buds have fallen over, and they're dead-looking, and it's about a foot and a half tall now, and the very top 6 inches where all the buds are just, the leaves are dead, and I don't know if I should cut those down and fertilize or just leave it alone?
Well, it's difficult to move something when it's actually actively growing or in leaf.
Oh.
And so we would prefer to move something like a rose in early spring before it leaves out.
Oh, dear.
So at this point, it's having a hard time because when you dig something up and move it, you do damage a part of the root system.
Uh-huh.
And when it's nice and warm and windy outside, those plants will lose a lot of moisture, but they may not be able to replace it at the same rate because they have a smaller root system now. So they can have a problem when that happens. And so you might see wilting, you might see some dieback. But the only thing you can do basically is to make sure it has plenty of moisture, keep it well watered.
Okay.
And hopefully the plant will eventually recover, and you might have to prune out some areas that actually die back. But hopefully the plant itself will survive. It may not do much this year as far as flowering,
okay,
but I think the main objective at this point is the plant survival.
Yes.
So mainly, no need to fertilize, but do keep it well watered.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Susan. We appreciate the call. Just getting back to the ash tree disease, that other diseases that ash trees can have, actually another news story that came out was a leaf falling or leaf drop that's taking place in ash trees has nothing to do, though, with this emerald ash borer. Is that accurate?
This is actually called anthracnose, and this is caused by a fungus. And anthracnose is a general term because there's a number of funguses depending on the tree species. There's also anthracnose on sycamore, which right now the sycamores look really bad. Do they look bad your way too, Richard?
Yep.
Yeah. And this is something that happens every spring, but it usually depends on the moisture level. And this year, I think the temperatures and the moisture and the amounts were just right, that it's pretty – appears fairly bad this year, I guess is what I want to say is – I mean, the sycamores look really ill, but what normally happens is they get infected – the leaves get infected, they fall off, and then usually I tell folks about mid-July, things start to kind of recover. If the temperatures come up, the moisture slows down, those trees will actually re-leaf. And a lot of times by mid-summer, depending on how bad it was, you may not really know that it happened. But this year it looks like it's going to be a little more severe, especially on the sycamores. I am seeing some leaf drop on the ash. At this point, there is nothing you can do to treat. That infection's already there. You cannot stop the infection. So in most cases, we don't recommend any treatment. The only treatments that can be used have to be preventative. And in most cases, that's not cost-effective either. So in general, it's going to look bad. Hang in there. But
ignore
it. But they generally come back. And the sycamores take it year after year. It can actually, on them too, this disease can actually attack the twigs. And so you'll get kind of twig dieback too during the season, and people talk about the sycamore being messy because it drops branches and leaves. And right now it's attacking those leaves just as they come out. So you've got these big, huge monster trees with a few green leaves, and then all of a sudden all you see is brown because these are the wilting leaves being impacted by this disease. Same thing with the ash. They'll generally come back from that, but a lot of times they can get pretty severe defoliation before they start to re-leaf.
Okay. We have emails coming in here at talkofiowa@uiowa.org. You can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. If you want to ask questions of DNR Forester Mark Vitosh or Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron today on Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, or give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. We'll be going into a break right now, but when we'll come back, we'll be taking calls and answering your questions. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander along with Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh. They'll take your questions about the plants in your life, 1-866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll go to Ken in Hanlontown. Ken, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Hi. Yes, I have a row of blue spruces that are approximately 25 years old, and I planted them for they're on the west side for a windbreak, and I think I planted them probably 78 feet apart. And now as they grow up, they're touching. I had somebody tell me that if they touch, they will die. And some of the branches are like in the middle of the trees are starting to die off. I didn't know if it was because of the big snowdrift that was there last year, or if it is because of it, they're touching.
Well, generally what happens, Ken, is those branches come together, they will start to shade. And those trees and those branches are not very tolerant to shade. So it's not as much as they're touching. It's the fact they're so close, they're starting to shade each other out, and you will start to get dieback. And in blue spruce, there actually are a number of needle diseases too. And when those plants become pretty dense, there's no air movement, and there's more susceptibility to those diseases, which can cause some dieback too. Generally on windbreak trees, especially with spruce, we'll generally have those spaced 20 to 22 feet apart ultimately. it takes a longer time for them to close, but they'll have more longevity the wider apart they are.
Sure.
So yeah. It's going to get worse as time goes. 7 to 8 feet is real close. This sounds harsh, but you may evaluate it and even think about taking every other one out at least, which would put you at 16 feet, which is better than nothing, because if you leave them, they're just going to continue to start dying back from below and getting worse over time.
That's what I was wondering, if I should take every other one out or just trim the dead branches off. Or
if you prune the dead branches off, you're just going to have to continue to do that. I mean, the thing that you have to ask yourself, do you want a tree that's going to have some lower branches, or do you want some trees that kind of look like truffula trees from the Lorax where everything gets pruned up and you have stuff, you know, on the tips?
Right.
You can do that, and that's fine, but longevity-wise, the more space they have to grow, the longer they're going to last. And again, with blue spruce, if they're open more and there's more air movement, there'll be less potential problems with that leaf needle fungus that they get.
Say, now, how big would a tree have to be too big to move? Could I get a tree spade and move some of them back, you know, like 12 feet or 15
feet? When they're that close together, the problem that you have is, I mean, generally the ideal movement for trees is when they're, probably 6 to 7 feet tall. Not much taller than that would be the ideal size to be moving if you're going to be using something like a tree spade. But if they're real close together and you're taking a large ball, you're going to cause significant damage to the trees that you're leaving.
The other trees.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and they're 20 feet tall now, so they're probably way too big then anyway. So, okay, I'll just probably cut every other one down then.
But that's something to consider. You might want to contact your local district forester sometime to see if they can just take a look and give you some other general ideas. But with them being that tight, you're probably going to have to consider something like that to try to improve the longevity.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ken. Good luck. We'll go next to Michelle in Van Horn. Michelle, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question?
Thank you very much. Rhubarb, when is it best to transplant them, and how long can I harvest them, and do I take several stalks per plant or what?
Well, as far as harvesting, we typically harvest, if we have a well-established plant, we can harvest until about early to mid June. We typically stop harvesting after that point because we want the plant to gain in strength so that they can produce a crop next year. As far as transplanting, basically we could do that in September or very early next spring. But if you do transplant it, you should leave it for 2 full growing seasons before you harvest anything, because you want the plant to basically recover from being transplanted, and that may take 2 years or so.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Michelle. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Terry in Dubuque. Terry, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Well, thank you for taking my call. Sure. I recently moved to a new home that has some gorgeous flowers, irises and tulips and poppies and a number of things. Unfortunately, they've been neglected for a number of years, and there's a number of weeds within these flower beds. There's this nasty little vine that wraps itself around the plants. There's all sorts of grasses and Queen Anne's lace. So I didn't know what's the best way to eradicate the weeds. Should I just go pull everything, or can I, at the end of the season, just, you know, napalm it all with some Roundup? I don't know what to do.
Yeah, it depends upon the weed. If they're annual weeds, you can oftentimes pull them or dig them out. But the perennial weeds oftentimes are much more difficult because they may have a taproot or they may spread from underground stems or rhizomes. So the perennial weeds tend to be more problematic. If you have a lot of perennial weeds that are hard to control, you may have to dig up the plants that you want to save and maybe put them in pots or set them aside and then try to destroy the weeds in the area. And that may take some time if it's a perennial weed. You could dig it up repeatedly. You could use Roundup, but more than one application may be necessary. But it may take some time to do that if it's some type of perennial weed. So I would try to get some idea what kind of weed it is and then go whichever way is best.
Okay.
Terry, I would take some samples into your extension office up there and just put them in baggies and some of the weeds that seem to be the worst, and then they can help you identify so you can see what the life cycles are and see if they are perennial versus annual, and that will help you in your strategy.
Okay, perfect. That's what I needed to know.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
We'll go next to Ann in Cedar Rapids. Ann, welcome to Horticulture Day. What's your question?
I have a magnolia tree that is, it must be like 50 years old. We've lived here for 25 years, and it was old when we moved in. And in the floods of 2008, that rainy season, I think it did a number on it with scale. We had really bad scale. And I treated it last year. I've sprayed it like in the fall, and I've put systemic insecticide down last year in the spring and then sprayed it in the fall, and I put systemic down again this year. And we've cut basically like half of it down. Is it too late? Should I be trying to do like a contact insecticide about now to get any crawlers that are out there?
What I would suggest is to call Donald Lewis, our entomologist here at Iowa State. Magnolia scale is very, very hard to control. It can be very hard to control. And I would discuss that situation with him. His phone number here at Iowa State is 515-294-1101. So 294-1101, and ask for Donald Lewis.
Okay.
And he'll be here on radio next week too. So,
okay.
I would ditto that. That insect is kind of a challenge. Scales in general are always kind of a challenge because the timing is pretty critical.
Uh huh. And I don't know. And I think, and I read online from the Iowa State Extension some of the stuff they have, and some of them say about spraying in the fall, and other times they talk about the crawlers getting them when the Japanese tree lilacs bloom, and it's sort of like when. And it sounds like you have to use multiple strategies to get this, whether it's trimming, systemic, or contact insecticide.
But the timing is really the key as far as controlling those.
And you're right. There's not going to be one silver bullet. It's one of those deals. And you're actually in kind of a zone where, for some reason, that insect is kind of bad on magnolias in general. I remember 10, 12 years ago, we went on a tree health tour, and we went into the Cedar Rapids area because that's where magnolia scale was, and I really don't see it in a lot of other places, but for some reason there's an area in that region where that just seems to be a problem.
Yeah, this is not a tree that we would have planted. The previous owners did. They also planted white birch, so so they've got two things from outside the zone in this yard. So anyway, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Ann. Good luck with that. We hope it works out for you. Thanks. We're going to take a break here, about a five-minute break. But when we return, Horticulture Day continues with Extension horticulturist Richard Giron and DNR forester Mark Vitosh. They'll be here to answer your questions. Call in at 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in a few moments.
Bacteria on a mission. This is the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams, in for Lester Graham. Scientists have engineered bacteria to seek out and destroy a chemical that pollutes drinking water. They're going after atrazine. It's banned in the European Union, but in the U.S., it's one of the most widely used pesticides on farms. It's also one of the most common chemicals found in drinking water supplies in the U.S. It's been linked to deformities in frogs and fish, and the Environmental Protection Agency is still trying to figure out how people might be affected. Justin Gallivan is a chemist at Emory University. His team genetically engineered a type of E. coli bacteria. They programmed it to seek out atrazine in a petri dish and destroy it. He says he knows a lot of people are uneasy about the idea of letting something that's genetically engineered out of the lab, but he says this engineered bacteria is too weak to survive in the wild.
It requires quite a bit of care and feeding, as you might say, to survive even in a petri dish. So if it were placed in a more harsh environment, is extremely likely that these types of organisms would not survive.
He says using this kind of bacteria to clean up pollution is still a very long way off. This is the Environment Report. A film about food waste is catching attention and awards at independent film festivals across the country. The film's called Dive. Reviewers are shocked by the film's statistics about how much edible food gets tossed out by grocery stores. Sean Ali reports they're also riveted by the filmmaker's personal story about diving after all that food.
Jeremy Seifert did not start dumpster diving to make a film. For a year or so, he did it for kicks. But that changed. Seifert is a filmmaker by trade, and he got a film assignment in an African refugee camp. The kids there had hardly any food.
They were truly hungry and suffering from hunger. And I came back home, and, you know, two nights later, I'm on my way to a dumpster pulling out a carload of food that had been thrown away. And that experience filled me with such outrage that I felt I needed to do something, and my expression was to make a film.
Seifert started filming his dumpster diving, but it got a new purpose. He wanted to show how he could practically feed his family on food taken out of grocery store dumpsters. He thought this dumpster diving would be easy, but now he felt guilty when he left food behind.
I'm tired of it. There's too much. And we only took this much because we didn't want it to go to waste, but it's like almost 2 a.m, and I don't have anywhere to put it, really.
But there was another problem. After he got food home, he was tempted to waste it. After all, it was free. Seifert worried this was setting a bad example for his son, and he talked to him about it on camera.
I don't know if dumpster diving and eating food from the dumpster has made me value food more or value food less, because it's easier now to throw food away because we have so much of it. And so part of me, I think that I'm valuing the food even less.
You can't waste
food. I know. I don't want to waste food. Do you want to waste food? I don't want to waste food either.
Seifert says that scene left quite an impression, so much that he's changed things a bit at home. Instead of dumpster diving so much, he gardens instead. That way his son can grow up really valuing all the food at the table.
And that's the Environment Report. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Support comes from the Park Foundation, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Great Lakes Fishery Trust. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
Horticulture Day.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulture's Richard Giron and DNR Forester Mark Vitosh are here to answer your questions about trees and other plants you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100. Or email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to our caller here. Jim in Northern Iowa. Jim, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you.
Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thank you. I have a maple tree that's probably about 8 years old, and last year I got some little black spots on the leaves, and the leaves all died off of it, and this year as it's growing back, none of the bottom branches are getting any leaves on it except at the very edges of them. The top branches are fine, but the bottom ones, all except for the very ends of them, there's no leaves on them. I just kind of wondered what's the cause of that. Is that tree going to die? Or
I would keep watching it. There were a number of leaf diseases last year, and sometimes we've had late frost that sometimes caused damage and caused blackening and spots on the leaves. There's also a fungus later in the summer called tar spot on maple that we see, but usually those things are kind of superficial, just kind of like this anthracnose. So usually you don't cause dieback. The thing I would worry about is if I was starting to lose leaves and stuff on the top of the tree, that to me, and I'm seeing dieback at the top, that to me usually is an indication of root damage, root problems. But if I'm losing a few of the inner branches, I mean, if it's an 8-year-old tree and it's starting to fill out a little bit, you will get a little bit of natural shading, so you'll lose some of the kind of little inner leaves and stuff, especially on a maple. They're kind of thick depending on the kind of maple it is.
Okay.
So, again, if I'm not getting top dieback and stuff, you may be getting just a little bit of shading on the inside. I guess the other thing I would do is if you're getting some leaf spots again and they show up, you know, take a few samples in the extension office and just see what it is to verify what's going on. But this time of year, and I know we had some last year, we get a number of different leaf spots on maples and a lot of different trees. But generally, those branches will leaf out the next year. So there may be some shading or something going on. Is the tree thickening up a little bit in general?
Not really.
It's not. It's thin throughout?
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to be growing real well. It got real tall pretty fast. But
just the inner branches are kind of not filling?
Yeah. It's not very thick at all, no. And like I said, the bottom branches, the very tips of the branches have good leaves on them this year, but all the rest of the way into the trunk of the tree, there's no leaves at all. They never came out at all.
And this is an 8-foot tree.
It's probably 20 feet.
Oh, it's 20 feet. Okay.
Yeah.
I would keep watching. Again, the fact if you're getting good growth and stuff, that's a good indication that things should be okay. I get more concerned if I'm getting a lot of tip dieback. Do you have anything to add to that, Richard, that you can think of?
Not offhand. If it's growing well, as far as, you know, if the branches are putting on some substantial new growth, like a foot, maybe foot and a half more, that would be a very encouraging sign.
Okay.
If the amount of growth, on the other hand, was quite small, let's say just 2 or 3 inches, that would be much more problematic. I would be worried about that. So I kind of base it on its vigor.
And if the leaves that are there are good sized and healthy and good color, that's a good sign. If they're small or distorted, or off color, yellow, or anything like that, that would be a concern. But again, like Richard said, if you have the other stuff and things look fairly decent, I would just kind of keep watching it and let her go.
Okay.
Sound good plan, Jim?
Yep, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. We appreciate it. We'll go next to Patty in Des Moines. Patty, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question?
Thank you for being my green thumb every week. I have annuals in pots outside. Some are in shade and some are in full sun and in between. And I want to know the best time to water them every day.
When you're watering plants in containers, it doesn't really matter that much. I would typically use a watering can and kind of stick it underneath the foliage if I could. And you can actually water any time during the day. If you water the plants and you get the foliage wet, then you typically would prefer to water in the morning and not the afternoon or evening. Because when you get the foliage wet, let's say you do it in the evening and you use a sprinkling can, but you get the foliage wet, that foliage is going to stay wet all night long. And the longer the foliage is wet, the greater the opportunity for disease. So you might see bigger disease problems if you water in the late afternoon or evening and get the foliage wet. But if you're actually watering the plant and not getting the foliage wet, you can do it any time during the day.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate the call, Patty. We have an email from Shannon in Cedar Rapids. She says, I bought a Gravenstein apple tree by mail order last year. The tree was bare-rooted and grafted onto a Canadian rootstock. If the seller of these trees can be believed, it's supposed to grow to 90% of the height of a non-rootstock grafted Gravenstein, but I guess the person's wondering if the tree was chopped off at 4 feet before it was shipped. The tree's diameter was over an inch thick, if that's relevant. She basically wants to know how can the top branches, she wants to end up with a nicely shaped tree in the end. So she's wondering about encouraging the top branches as opposed to the side branches. Does this make sense?
Well, it's difficult.
Okay.
I don't quite understand it fully.
Okay.
You would like to have a nice shape to the tree,
right?
But it's kind of unclear as far as what it looks like right
now.
The
tree's diameter was over an inch thick. Picture a 4-foot tall tree with side branches 3 feet in length or so, branching off at a 90-degree angle to the trunk.
We do have a publication on pruning and training fruit trees, and they can always check that out. It has some diagrams and shows you how to basically go about doing it.
Okay.
But her description is kind of vague.
Okay.
He or she.
Okay. We'll go to Kathy in Webster City and hope for some other emails at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Kathy in Webster City is joining us on the phone at 1-866-780-9100.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hello, Kathy. What's your question?
I have a very large area on a steep hillside of vinca, and I want to save it, but it is becoming innervated with a lot of rhizome weeds. I kind of thought I might try to remove that and still save the vinca, remove those weeds, but I'm not sure the best method to do it.
That's going to be difficult to do if you have some type of grassy weed in there.
Mm-hmm.
Most of your grasses spread by underground stems are rhizomes,
mm-hmm.
and you basically, one way of destroying them is to dig them up. That's one possibility. But there's nothing selective that would kill the weeds and not the vinca.
That's what I was
so
wondering.
That's the problem.
Okay. If I went out there with loppers and cut off the top, the canopy of weeds, because they're above the vinca, and then used a diluted solution of Roundup to spray on those cut edges, would that do it? If I did it repeatedly, would it filter down and get and kill the vinca? If that diluted Roundup solution was in contact.
Well, if the weeds are some type of perennial type grass, like quack grass or something of that nature,
they're just weeds of all kinds. I think they're rhizome in nature. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you can try pulling them, and if the entire root system comes out, you can pull.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
annual weeds will pull, and you can get the entire root system.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do that, you can just pull them out. It may take a lot of time, but you can just pull them out. If you try pulling them and they break off,
mm-hmm.
that would kind of suggest maybe it's a perennial weed and you're not getting all the root system.
Right.
And if that's the situation, you really can't pull them out.
Mm-hmm.
Then you might have to decide what to do. One option might be, if these are basically a lot of perennial weeds, you might decide to maybe dig up some of the vinca, put it in pots,
mm-hmm.
try to salvage some of it, and then go out there and simply destroy everything that remains.
Mm-hmm.
And that may take some time, but you could put the vinca in some pots, set them aside, keep them well cared for, and they'll be fine, and then proceed to slowly destroy what's in the bed area. And that may take a few weeks or maybe a few months.
Okay.
And then when you're basically satisfied, you're confident that all the weeds are destroyed, then you can replant.
Yeah. This is a yearly progression of weed growth over the vinca, overtaking the vinca. It's a large area, so I suppose what we're saying is I'll just have to let the vinca be destroyed as well to start over, because I couldn't repot and plant and carry on, I don't believe. Yeah, it's too big an area. Well, I thank you.
Well, thanks for calling, Kathy. Good luck. Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Margaret in Washington, Iowa. Margaret, welcome to the program. What's your question? Margaret? Well, maybe Margaret will call back. We'll go to Lisa in Newton. Lisa, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day.
Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
I have a clematis that every year, several times during the year, will die off and come back from the roots.
Right. That's referred to as clematis wilt. We're really not sure why they do it. About the only thing you can do is when that does occur, you basically cut off the wilted stem near the ground and remove it and destroy it. Typically what happens is the plant will then send up new shoots, healthy shoots, but this does happen on occasion, and we're not sure of the exact reason.
Should I just buy a replacement plant? Because I've had it for like 4 years, and it just, you know, I can't get a full clematis out of it ever.
Well, at some point, you might decide to kind of pull the plug, yes, and maybe remove that plant. If I was going to plant another clematis in the area, I wouldn't put it back exactly in the same location. I would find a site a little bit farther away from that, maybe by 2 or 3 feet, just to be on the safe side.
Okay. Is there a certain type of clematis that grows faster and fuller?
There are many, many varieties that you can buy as far as flower color, vigor, things like that. The one that's very, very common and very vigorous is Jackmanii, or Jackman. It has dark bluish-purple flowers, very, very vigorous, very healthy, grows quite nicely. It blooms typically June, July. There's also the sweet autumn clematis that blooms actually in August, early September, with small white flowers, but a very vigorous plant, has many, many small white flowers on it, so very, very showy.
How about those suggestions? Thanks, Lisa.
Wonderful, thanks.
Good luck. Bye-bye. We'll go to with email here from Susan in West Des Moines. How do you keep geraniums looking like they do when you purchase them from the nursery with the big, beautiful flower clusters? I have them planted in the ground, not in pots. Any suggestions there?
Well, the main thing is they need partial to full sun. And the other thing is that when the flower heads are basically gone, once they die, make sure that you deadhead those. Remove the spent flowers. The main aim of the geranium plant is to flower and produce seed. And as long as you remove the seed head before they have a chance to produce seed, they just keep on blooming. So it's important to deadhead those as soon as the seed head or the flower head is basically gone.
Okay. We'll go next to Doug in Moline, Illinois. Doug, welcome to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. What's your question?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have an American sycamore that's approximately about 50 years old, and we're seeing extensive leaf drop. Generally, when we get a frost, the leaves come out early and they're tender. Those die back, and then we get another growth. Right now, though, what I'm experiencing is leaves are basically hand-sized that are falling, that are green, that are covered on the underside with a white crystalline substance. Probably about 20% of the underside of the leaf has this growth on it. Any idea what it might be, and is the tree in danger of dying?
Actually, Doug, what you have, the white crystal is actually pubescence or hairs that are very common on sycamore.
These are, I mean, not just a uniform coating. They're actually built up, in some cases, maybe as much as a 16th to an eighth of an inch.
But the thing that's actually causing the problem on your tree is anthracnose. We talked about that earlier. I've looked at a lot of sycamores on that side of the state. I've actually been driving over there every day, putting up gypsy moth traps in the last 2 weeks. And what's happening, a lot of these leaves are actually turning brown just as they come out, and other leaves are curling. And that's actually caused by anthracnose, which is pretty significant. And this year, because of all the moisture we're having. Now, the white crystals, I'm not quite sure what that might be, but I don't think that's probably associated with your problem. I mean, if your sycamore is looking pretty unhealthy and a lot of wilting and a lot of leaves just falling off, when anthracnose gets bad, leaves will even fall off without turning brown.
Yeah, I've got both. I've got the brown leaves, the curled leaves, and the green leaves that are falling.
Right, and that is anthracnose, and it's really widespread clear over into central Iowa. Most years it's not this bad, but I think our temperatures and the amount of moisture we've had has just been just right. What we said earlier, usually about July, things will usually kind of turn around because that disease will slow down, the infections will slow down, you'll get new leaves on, and they'll tend to come back. But right now, on my morning walk this morning, I was looking. I mean, I had leaves hit me in the head as I walked. I mean, it's kind of rain and leaves, especially sycamore right now. As far as the crystals, you might take that into local extension office and see if there's something else, but I don't think that's associated with the problem that you're having overall on the tree. I'm pretty sure you're dealing with probably pretty severe anthracnose.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your call.
No problem.
Calling
No problem.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Doug. We appreciate it. And the treatment for that is?
Right
nothing.
Now, there's nothing you can do.
Nothing. Okay.
There are treatments that can be done preventively. There's actually some injections, but that can be pretty expensive, and you'd really have to have a big specimen tree that you want to try to protect.
Right. So just leave it alone right now. All right, we'll go next to Jim in Davenport. Jim, welcome to the program.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a couple questions about peach trees. Both of them, well, we have an old overgrown orchard, and there's an older peach tree it's kind of dying. So there's a couple volunteers that came from seeds. One of them is quite a bit bigger than the other. The smaller one has not yet gotten to the point where it's produced blossoms. And the bigger one that we transplanted, I'll come back to that one. The first one, I've heard it said that fruit trees will not grow from seeds. They only have to be like transplanted from rootstock. Is that accurate?
You can grow fruit trees from the seeds, but when you buy, for example, a certain apple, let's say you buy a Red Delicious apple and you plant that, it produces fruit. You take the seed from that fruit and plant the seed. The seed will grow, but it's not going to give you a Red Delicious apple.
Oh, okay.
It'll be genetically different somewhat, okay? And therefore, when you buy a Red Delicious apple, the only way to really propagate that is to use some other means like grafting or budding. That way, it's genetically the same plant.
Got it. And that's okay, because we just wanted to see if we could, because the old tree is going to die, and we wanted to see if we could carry on kind of the gene line one way or the other with these volunteers. But the second question I have, it was a much bigger tree, and I know that it actually produced blossoms, and so I figured we know that it has the capacity of producing fruit. But when we transplanted it, we waited till way too late in the spring, and I wasn't able to get as much of the root ball unharmed as I wanted, and so we had quite a bit of almost entire leaf drop. If we keep it watered, that tree watered through the summer, is it possible that the tree would survive? I mean, I'm not asking for a guarantee, but
right.
It could, but you
may not really know until maybe next year, for
sure. And that's okay. I didn't know if it was worth the effort to continue to water it through this summer, even though there's no leaves on it, in the hope that plant would, or the tree would, come back next spring.
No, it's going to have to leaf out sometime in the next few weeks, very soon. If it does not do so, then you can assume it's basically dead. It cannot stay dormant from this point until next year. It's going to have to leaf out, and leaf out fairly soon. If it doesn't do that, then you can probably assume it's dead.
You could lightly scrape it with your fingernail right now just to see if there's green underneath the bark, and that'll give you some indication if there's hope. If it's not green, that's not good.
Well, the green, the bark is absolutely, I mean, you don't even have to scrape it. It's absolutely green, but it was fully leafed out, fully out before we went to transplant it, and all those leaves fell off. Would it re-sprout new leaves this year, do you think?
It very well could. If it's still alive, it will. If it's still alive, it will. It has secondary buds that it can basically use to leaf out again. But again, it's going to have to do that very soon.
Okay.
It cannot stay basically bare from this point until fall and survive. It has to leaf out again. So I would assume that it's still alive. I would water when necessary, and then hope I see a few leaves in the next few weeks. And if I do, then it's okay for the time being. But it still may be so very, very weak that it may not survive the winter. So let's say it does produce a few leaves, it still is alive, then next spring becomes the next important date. If it leaves out next spring, then it has survived the really rough period.
Thanks, Jim.
We're going to move on, but we wish you luck with the peach, with the trees.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. We'll go quickly to Sarah in Iowa City. Sarah, welcome to the program. In our remaining moments of Horticulture Day, what's your question?
I have two curry leaf plants, which are growing in just as small trees. I keep them in pots, put them out in the summer, and bring them in the winter. And every year I take off the new shoots and distribute them to people who want them. And I also trim the top of the plants so that they don't grow too big. But I want to know, can I do both those things at the same time, or is it better to separate the shoots at one time and trim off the top leaves at a different time?
What kind of plants are they again?
They're called curry leaf plants, and you know, we use them in Indian cooking. I don't know what the official name is. Mm-hmm. Like I said, grow outside as trees in India, small trees.
I guess I don't really know offhand. I'm not familiar with that plant.
But in general, when you're doing that, if you're taking off shoots and you're trimming the tops, can you do that at the same time safely again and again?
You can typically remove the shoot tips and root those if you'd like, and you can do that at various times during the year. Yes, you can.
Well, to take it out, I have to take the
whole
plant.
Thanks, Sarah. We're
going
to have to go, but thank you very much. Good luck. We appreciate the call. Another Horticulture Day is done, but we'll be back next week, Friday. And we'd like to thank DNR Forester Mark Vitosh and Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. We had technical assistance by Christina Sarnelli today. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.